to On Demand with Jenna Ellis. This is our AFR exclusive podcast where we get to do a deeper dive into the issues that you want to hear more about from the people you want to hear more from. And so today we have Jeremy Carl, who is a senior fellow at the Claremont Institute, a former research fellow at the Hoover Institute, and the author of the book, The Unprotected Class, How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart. And Jeremy, so glad to have you today on Demand.
Thanks so much, Jenna. It's a pleasure to be on.
Yeah, and so, you know, there was this interesting exchange in the midst of, you know, everything going on this week with Ukraine and the Oval Office brawl, if I can characterize it that way, and, you know, how the U.S. really hasn't, over the Biden administration, articulated really any national interest in sending all of this money to Ukraine, and yet, you know, if President Trump isn't willing to support Ukraine, then he must be a Putin sympathizer. And, you know, these really interesting ways that at least the left is trying to set this up, I think is terrible framing. But there was an interesting exchange with Congressman Brandon Gill, really amazing congressman. I think he's one of the up-and-coming great leaders of the Republican movement, where he said this: mass migration is a far greater threat to Western civilization than Putin is. And you responded, anyone who doesn't understand this truth should not be anywhere near the levers of power in the United States. So, Jeremy, unpack that for us a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm a big fan of Brandon's as well, and I think he's going to do great things. But yeah, it's essentially that regardless of what one thinks of Putin, and I think, you know, regardless of a lot of the propaganda being spewed by the left, I think that everybody on the right understands, or the vast majority of people, at least on the right, that at the very least, he's a strategic adversary of the United States, if not worse. And I think there's a good faith disagreements that people can have there about, you know, how much we need to worry about Putin. But, you know, Vladimir Putin is not a fundamental threat to American national identity. Vladimir Putin is not, you know, kind of bringing illegals into the country. He's not bankrupting the U.S. through doing that. Vladimir Putin is not a threat to American national identity. Vladimir Putin is not a kind of direct threat to the American people and our kind of very idea of nationhood. Whereas mass migration, which is fundamentally changing the entire kind of composition of who the American people is, that is potentially a really big threat to American nationhood.
Yeah, so this is, I think, gets into the broader question of what America First really means, because I think that the globalists, certainly on the left, and those who would say that, you know, the United States has to engage in every conflict that we're invited to, and because we're, you know, world leader, then we have to have an opinion on everything and all of these things. But in terms of America First, and certainly Western civilization first, I agree with you, Jeremy, in this sense that there are far greater threats, even, you know, from within. I think that the whole DEI movement, the topic even, you know, of your book, The Unprotected Class, and, you know, talking about how the larger conversation about how the left has transformed natural rights into civil rights in America and trying to basically reframe liberty. I mean, all of these ideological things, as well as the Mexican cartels and fentanyl across the border, not securing our border, looking at, you know, the heinous murders and other violence against Americans. I mean, so many things we could point to. And yet somehow, you know, Putin is held up as, and I'm certainly not suggesting, you know, that he's some great guy or anything, but I agree with you in this sense that I don't think he poses the same existential threat, at least to the United States or Western civilization and culture, as the left is trying to portend. So where do we rightly fit this whole Ukraine-Russia conflict in the broader context of where America fits into this?
Yeah, well, Jen, I certainly agree with your comments. I think there's a couple things that I need to do. I mean, because even sometimes I am I'm not sure, you know, these are complicated issues, right, about exactly how we should deal with them. So you sort of look at what is the behavior of the people who are kind of really pushing sort of a maximal conflict on other issues that I care about, not just migration, And I think what you find is the people who are gung-ho for us to be most aggressive, being pro-Ukraine, are generally, not exclusively, but generally pretty terrible on all the issues that you just outlined. They're among the weaker voices, if they're even on our side at all, in our party. And, you know, if you'll forgive a kind of a little bit of a gruesome metaphor, but one that I've used in the past, I think it's a little bit like if you're watching a political argument with two people and there's a crowd in front of them, and all of a sudden one of them got out and they took out a gun and shot a baby in the face in the middle of the political argument, and they just continued the political argument, as if nothing had happened. Which side of that political argument, even if you didn't know anything about the specific subject being argued about, I think I'd probably be pretty inclined to side with the person who's not shooting babies. So that's sort of how I feel a little bit. It's like, if the really aggressive pro-Ukraine side is right, then I think we are making an assumption that these guys who happen to not really seem to be doing things in my interest and any other thing that I can measure somehow really do have my interest in mind when it comes to what's going on with Russia and Ukraine.
Yeah, and there was a troll tweet similarly with the whole current state of the UK, because, you know, obviously the issues going on there with their culture and, you know, a lot of the, frankly, Islamic influence and, you know, a lot of these things. And yet, you know, Keir Starmer is suggesting that, you know, Europe, that Putin is, you know, the greatest threat and, you know, is all kinds of rhetoric and everything following that Oval Office meeting. And this was the troll tweet from an account called Rob Jenkins at Prof on the Right. He said, if Putin isn't stopped, all of Europe could succumb to totalitarianism. People could be jailed for social media posts. They could be threatened with arrest for praying in their homes. Rape gangs and child traffickers could run rampant. It's too awful to contemplate. Well, that's already happening, absent Putin. I mean, you know, it's kind of like they're trying to just make him and this whole conflict the center of the crisis of Western civilization and literally ignore what's really going on.
No, that's absolutely right. I saw that tweet. It was really brilliant because it does get to the heart of it, right? I mean, and I think even more what's happening in Europe, because I think without kind of getting off topic, I mean, you know, you can make arguments for a more immigration-focused America. I don't necessarily buy them, but within American tradition, you can do that. Whereas the replacement of these European populations by people from totally different civilizations and culture really has no precedent in those countries' recent, you know, histories going back hundreds of years, if not more. And sort of the notion that the people who are somehow enabling this and threatening to jail people who disagree with them are nonetheless so deeply concerned with their fellow citizens and are expressing that through support of Ukraine as the great existential issue, it just doesn't pass the laugh test. And I think that's what Rob Jenkins' tweet was really brilliantly getting at.
And I'm speaking with Jeremy Carl, who's a senior fellow at the Claremont Institute, and his book is The Unprotected Class, How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart. And Jeremy, you know, so how do we as conservatives correctly respond to some of these gimmicks, frankly, on the left that are trying to basically hold up, you know, Ukraine? If you support Ukraine, then you're on the right side of history. And, you know, we see idiots like Adam Kinzinger that is always posting like Slava Ukraini and with the little, you know, the Ukraine flag in his bio. And I love the memes that are trolling it, like I stand with Blockbuster because of the two colors of the Ukraine flag. I mean, that's how kind of ridiculous it is. But then, you know, if you're not pro-Ukraine, then you must be pro-evil, pro-Putin, pro, you know, everything that, you know, is wrong with, like, you know, the what is it, the Sith, you know, that are like Darth Vader. I mean, it's literally that comical. So how do we as conservatives frame our position better to not be drawn into that straw man?
Yeah, I think J.D. Vance has actually done a really nice job of this on X and elsewhere, where he's just said, look, you know, sometimes, and maybe now I'm expanding a little bit, I don't know if he said this directly, but sometimes you're faced with two not great choices, right? Like, there is no wonderful choice. The wonderful choice would have been If Joe Biden hadn't been in the White House, I don't think that Putin would have tried this in the first place, and then we might not have been in that situation. But now we're in this situation. As realists who are concerned first and foremost with the American interest, you know, we need to talk about just acknowledging the realities on the ground. And I think if we could all wave a magic wand, of course, Putin would retreat back to his pre-2022 borders, and we'd leave it at that. But we need to acknowledge that he has interest. Russia has interest. They've put in a lot of blood and treasure, just as the Ukrainians have. And the notion that we are going to somehow be able to magically reverse those geopolitical realities is just not realistic, given the other priorities we have, given the fact that our so-called NATO allies in Europe have been so unhelpful on the military piece of this. And so it's really, I think we overcome some of this rhetoric with just realism, and that doesn't mean that we're bloodless. I think it's important to talk about the moral dimensions to this conflict as well and to acknowledge them, but we need to say, look, we're living in the world of reality, and a lot of these guys seem to think it's a video game. And I think also Trump has done a really good job of just talking about, you know, the number one thing we want to do is stop feeding conscripts from either side into a meat grinder. I mean, that's a real humanitarian and Christian impulse that I think we have that we should absolutely encourage.
Yeah. And so what about the broader conversation of preserving Western civilization, our Judeo-Christian founding, and identifying and actively pursuing eliminating some of these consequences of moving toward furthering a post-truth society, not just, you know, in the context of the Ukraine-Russia conflict, but overall, I think that the left would like us to ignore that bigger problem in favor of news of the day.
Absolutely. Well, and of course, Ukraine is tragically a Christian-on-Christian war. It's as people have commented on, it's a European-on-European war, two things that we have not seen in some time, at least in that region. And I think, yeah, these broader civilizational issues are much bigger. People don't want to talk about the hollowing out of the Christian character of the United States, although it actually does look like maybe we're seeing some data that maybe finally that's turning around a little bit. But people don't want to talk about our historic identity, our culture, what we need to do to preserve that, and how letting in infinity immigrants from everywhere in the world threatens that identity in some pretty fundamental ways in many cases. So people don't want to have that conversation. And what I've seen regularly is when people don't want to have those conversations, they sort of love to do the look a squirrel. And the look a squirrel in this case is the Russia-Ukraine war, where we can all go feel really brave about what we're doing somewhere thousands of miles away while we're ignoring what goes on right in our front doorstep. And that needs to stop.
Yeah, absolutely. So do you think, Jeremy, that Donald Trump gets this whole kind of multifaceted picture? Is it just, you know, purely the art of the deal and pro-America and pro-economy and some of these things? But I mean, I personally think Donald Trump has a worldview. I wouldn't necessarily characterize it as particularly Judeo-Christian in some respects. I think that he certainly understands and pursues some basic moral truth that's grounded in natural law, like objecting to men and women's sports. And, you know, you can't change your gender for minors. But yet, on the other hand, you know, he is an advocate for people like Bruce Jenner becoming Caitlyn. And so, you know, there's kind of this mixed bag here with the kind of godless populism. But at the same time, I see his worldview not being too far off. I mean, so I guess how would you characterize what he's doing in sort of the Venn diagram of a solid Christian biblical worldview that you and I would articulate and pursue? And frankly, is why I supported DeSantis in the primary, and a lot of fellow conservative Christians did. And then with Donald Trump and his worldview, you know, kind of what, how much of that overlaps, and maybe where are the outside margins?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I think, you know, look, obviously I don't know Donald Trump's heart. I don't have a relationship with him in a personal way in that way. I think that the weight of the presidency inevitably leads to growth spiritually and otherwise when you have that type of burden on you. And I think in the wake of the assassination attempt on Trump, you saw a lot of people commenting on certain changes in the president and his demeanor and his focus in that regard. And I think coming face-to-face with your own mortality, you know, for any person who's even on the periphery of kind of serious Christianity, I mean, I think it's a very mean, or even an atheist in some ways, right? Like, it has an effect on you. I did see, I'm trying to remember from who it was, but somebody who was describing to me, or it was on Twitter, that they were sort of saying that they had been in the Oval Office with Trump when it was announced to him, basically, the number of Ukrainians and Russians that had been killed in the last month, and that he had seemed really quite personally affected by that from a humanitarian perspective and really wanting to stop the meat grinder. So I do think that, of course, totally appropriately, the president is putting America first, trying to do the art of the deal here and keeping his eye on realism. But I do think that there's also a humanitarian impulse that is here that he is trying to serve. And I think it's a good one. It should be encouraged.
Yeah, and I agree with that, Jeremy. And I think it's been really fascinating to see Trump 2.0 and perhaps a lot different and frankly better than some of us were anticipating, particularly after the Republican Party, you know, changed their platform and watered down things like traditional marriage and you know some of these other things, certainly the life issues. And yet that appeared to be more just for campaigning. And now that he's actually in office, is doing a lot of really great things. I mean, even pardoning the people who were wrongly and in my view, falsely prosecuted under the FACE Act just for being pro-life activists and advocates. You know, some of these things that he didn't necessarily have to do, didn't promise in the campaign, unlike pardoning the J6ers, for example. Yet he's making some really good moves. So as conservatives, and, you know, that for purposes of this conversation, we could define that as people who have, you know, core principles that don't yield to any given news cycle or campaign cycle or politician. You know, we're fixed in our principles. Of course, how we apply those principles is different given the landscape. But for those of us who have those core principles, how do you see that we can best encourage the good impulses of and actions of Trump 2.0 while not falling into perhaps the trap of, well, if we're critical at all, then we'll get called traitors and losers or whatever on social media, which who cares? But to kind of find that right balance.
Yeah, I mean, and it's always a tricky question. I mean, what you're sort of outlining, Jenna, I think is the kind of very essence of prudential politics. And I also think it depends on what role you have within the movement, you know, sort of how you assess your role. I think the thing that certainly I try to do is to be very aggressive about praising things that I really like. If I don't like something, I'm going to generally maybe say critique it in a spirit of love, if that makes sense. But I think it's really important that at the end of the day, you know, people understand that like we're doing this as friends who want the administration to succeed, that we're happy overall with the things that are going on, and that we would just like you know, X or Y to be better. Again, you know, depending on where you are, you might hit harder on the critical piece, or you might pull your punches even more. But I think, you know, kind of continuing to articulate our principles, making clear what they are, and I often find, I think particularly with President Trump, you know, praising him for a lot of the really great things that he's doing will go a long way. And so that's certainly what I try to do. You know, you need to keep in mind the particular people you're dealing with and the particular issues. And at the same time, I think you can articulate the sort of Christian principles and other principles that we stand for in a really clear way and sort of understand what those are and make sure that other people do as well.
Yeah, really well said. And I couldn't agree more. So just to wrap here, and Jeremy Carl, I really appreciate your time this morning to do this deeper dive. So, you know, we've seen the Oval Office meeting. We've kind of seen, you know, what's going on with the Ukraine and Russia conflict. Going back to that, Just kind of in last comments, where do you see this going? I mean, obviously, this didn't get resolved in 24 hours, but Glenn Beck pointed out that Russia is certainly losing because it thought it could come in and basically be done and take over Ukraine in 2 weeks. That didn't happen. So it's almost at a little bit potentially of a stalemate, which is where Trump has the opportunity to negotiate a good resolution. Where do you see this ultimately going, and do you think Trump will accomplish the art of the deal?
I actually think he will. I think he's going to get this done. I think he's been much more clear-eyed strategically about this than a lot of his critics. And I think, you know, the thing that people don't even talk about at all that I've heard Trump articulate, which is why I get so annoyed when people are kind of bashing Trump as being a simpleton. I'm like, no, actually, he's thinking several steps above you. Is just, I think his overarching thing that he has talked about, if you're careful in listening, is to keep Russia and China apart. That he doesn't want a Russia-China alliance, that is profoundly negative for the entire West, but particularly for American interests. And I think that he perceives that by that he has some leverage with both the Ukrainians and the Russians here, and that by doing the right sort of deal and by conspicuously declining to attack Putin personally a lot. And again, he said this, I'm not kind of revealing anything out of school here. He said, you know, I'm not going to go bash the guy and then say, hey, Vlad, you know, how's the deal going? Right. So he's just, I think he's being very practical about how he gets this done. I think he will. And I think it will, as a result of getting some sort of a deal done, that is not going to be something that anybody loves, but that will stop the bloodshed. Mm-hmm. I think that this will create some sort of a break to some degree or distance between China and Russia. And I think that will be very good for our long-term strategic interests. And frankly, just the stopping of war anywhere near the European continent will be in everybody's strategic interest. So I don't expect that Donald Trump is going to be gifted a Nobel Prize, even if he does do that. But I think he is very much looking out for the American interest. I'm supportive of what he's doing here. I think it's a very difficult negotiation, but I think it would be very foolish to bet against President Trump in the context of these types of negotiations where he's had a lot of success in high-stakes negotiations throughout his career.
Yeah, absolutely. And I certainly am with you that I don't think he'll get a Nobel Prize because he didn't even get one for the Abraham Accords, which he really should have, quite frankly. And I think if he were anybody else, if this were Obama, if this were anybody else, he absolutely would have. So, you know, but whatever. Those are they're handing those out to just all of their leftist friends. So it's kind of a meaningless category at this point. But it remains to be seen. And for Christians, we should be praying for our leaders. We should be praying for everyone in the Trump administration to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with the Lord, which is really the first and foremost way that we can pray for them and encourage them to walk uprightly in their capacity as the elected, obviously, and then everyone that Trump decides to hire that serve at the pleasure. So Jeremy Carl, always really appreciate your commentary. You can follow him at Real Jeremy Carl, and you can read his book, The Unprotected Class, How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart. You've been listening to On Demand with Jenna Ellis, and I really appreciate all of our listeners who constantly write in with suggestions for topics or questions that they have. Listeners, you know, the guests that you want to hear from, and we got a lot of comments since the Oval Office meeting saying, you know, can we do kind of a bigger worldview picture of what's going on here? So that's why we focused today on that, because of you, because you have written in, and you can always reach me and my team, Jenna at AFR.net. And I will see you on demand next Friday. And as always, you can also listen to the live morning show from 8 to 9 Eastern at AFR.net. Find your local station or also anytime on our AFR app.